I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's April 25th, and we have a lot to talk about. I'm in Boston this week, attending the American Academy of Neurology annual meeting, and I'm looking forward to bringing you news and interviews from this conference in an upcoming episode of the podcast. But before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you to spend less than 5 minutes taking the Real Talk MS listener survey. And to add a little motivation to this invitation, once you complete the survey, you can choose to be entered into a drawing for a $100 Amazon gift card. To get to the survey, just visit realtalkms.com/survey. And to make it even easier to get to the survey, you'll find that link in today's show notes. So I hope you'll do me this small favor, complete the survey, and maybe win a $100 Amazon gift card. Today we're talking about a set of MS symptoms that can range in intensity from mildly annoying to completely debilitating. We're talking about some of the common sensory symptoms that someone living with MS might encounter. These are symptoms that include numbness, tingling, pain, that electric shock feeling you might experience traveling down the back of your neck, the infamous MS hug. And joining me to walk us through how to best manage these sensory symptoms is Dr. Jeffrey Hernandez. Dr. Hernandez is a doctorally prepared nurse practitioner who specializes in multiple sclerosis. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Hernandez, there are a few other things that you should know about. Last week, I added a bonus episode to the Real Talk MS Mix, and I want to thank those of you who have already listened and shared some of your very positive feedback about that episode with me. If you missed last week's announcement, I want you to imagine what it would be like to sit down for a series of private one-on-one conversations with five brilliant MS researchers, getting their perspective on the MS research landscape, talking about their work, asking them about what emerging research has them excited about the future. Well, that's exactly what I had a chance to do at this year's annual meeting of the America's Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis, better known as the ACTRIMS Forum. One of the events that takes place each year at the ACTRIMS Forum is the awarding of the Barancic Prize for Innovation in Multiple Sclerosis Research. And this year, several past Barancic Prize winners gathered to honor the 10th anniversary of the Barancic Prize. I had some great one-on-one conversations with five past Barancic Prize winners, and I put those conversations together in a two-part special podcast series titled Barancic Prize Conversations. And this week, you can listen to both parts one and two of this special series. Both episodes are available now at realtalkms.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or you can simply point your web browser to realtalkms.com/Barancic1, that's Barancic, then the numeral 1, or realtalkms.com/Barancic2, with the numeral 2. And you'll be able to listen to my conversations with five Barancic Prize winners in parts one and two of Barancic Prize Conversations. I found my conversations with these game-changing scientists fascinating, and I think you will too. I hope you give parts one and two of the Barancic Prize Conversations a listen, and you'll find those links in today's show notes. Elizabeth Jameson is a world-renowned artist living with progressive MS. I'm proud to call Elizabeth a friend, and if you'd like to learn more about Elizabeth's work and her MS journey, please be sure to check out episode number 48 of Real Talk MS, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. Over the past few years, Elizabeth has shared her perspective on living with progressive MS through YouTube videos and thought-provoking essays that have been published in major newspapers, including the New York Times and San Francisco Chronicle. I've always tried to share news about Elizabeth's essays and videos with you because I find them not only beautifully done and really informative, but also emotionally honest. Elizabeth Jamison's latest essay was published recently in the San Francisco Chronicle, and I think this essay represents an honest and real portrayal of living with advanced progressive MS. Because this essay is behind a paywall, I can't offer you a link, so I'd like to share it by reading it to you instead. In 2017, I gave a TEDx talk on celebrating the disabled body. At the time, having suffered for half a lifetime from multiple sclerosis and quadriplegia, I thought I had experienced enough to settle into my imperfect body and even find happiness within it. I was truly proud of having a disability, of having found peace and even pride in that identity. From my wheelchair, I delivered my talk with impassioned joy in the hope that others, regardless of disability status, would join me in celebrating the gift of our bodies, disabled or not. By embracing the perfect body, you have to celebrate disease and disability and illness, I said, because each and every one of us will have disease and illness and disability in our lifetime. I truly meant it. But 5 years later, as the losses have continued and cut even more deeply, I know that I would not give that upbeat, lighthearted speech today. The word celebrate is not the word I would use to describe my relationship with my body. If there is a word, I haven't been able to find it. But I have discovered a place where I see it reflected. The scorched earth of California's fire-ravaged Trinity Mountains. About 200 miles north of San Francisco, my family and I have gone on vacation to these mountains every summer since my kids were born, and our most recent trip was shortly after a fire had raged through the area the previous summer. The majesty of this forest, where I spent so much time collecting memories and bathing in serenity, was altered nearly beyond recognition. The fire had licked the edges of the trees and left its mark mere feet from where I was sitting on the porch of our cabin. There was so much loss and devastation, and yet sprouts of new growth arose from the blackened fallout. This was the first time I'd seen the impact of fire close up, so close that I could smell the remaining ashes. I found myself contemplating the scarred ground, the transformation of the forest, and my altered view of this terrain. The devastated landscape seemed to express my journey with chronic illness. Like the fires that are increasing in area and intensity each year, the progressive and cumulative damage from MS is not necessarily surprising, but nonetheless, it is frightening. It is seemingly unstoppable, just like these ever more frequent and petrifying flames. I am in a perpetual state of awareness about the inescapable impermanence of everything, including my mind and body. But this is not how I used to think about my disease. When I gave my TEDx talk, I thought I knew what I could lose, having been forced by the disease to reinvent myself so much. Over the course of my MS, I transitioned from serving as a public interest lawyer to becoming an artist. My paintings, etchings, and embroidery, characterized by bold and vibrant colors, transformed my MRIs into images that conveyed my humanity and the complexity of my journey with chronic illness. When I lost the use of my hands and could no longer hold a paintbrush, I had to reimagine my life's purpose again. But I did not imagine that MS would take anything more from me. I was wrong. It did. At the time of my talk, I had yet to realize that I would just keep losing more and more. But that is what's happened. Today, my diminished capacity to speak audibly means my voice sounds weak. Syllables fall off and speaking can be exhausting. I also experience episodes of aphasia, moments when I lose the ability to understand certain nuances of language. I feel myself forever groping for an elusive word. I sometimes lose certain subtleties of conversation or struggle to reliably express what I am thinking and feeling. That is a special kind of agony for me, a former lawyer who fought her every battle using words. Even now, my collaborator, Lucia Graves, is helping to string together the beads of my ideas into these sentences and paragraphs. My newest adventure is sleeping with a ventilator because MS is weakening my diaphragm and diminishing my capacity to breathe. When every unwelcome symptom of my disease first appeared, I assumed they would be temporary losses, and I always found ways to deal with them. But I know now that MS means consistent phases of loss. It was just that they happened so slowly that I was able to adjust. I was coping and upbeat and full of gratitude because I thought I had hit rock bottom with the loss of arms and legs. Now I am scared that I won't be able to cope if I progress much more. I won't be able to physically, sure, but emotionally even more so. I worry that I won't be able to maintain any sort of connection with anyone if I lose my ability to speak. That's what I was thinking about on the porch of our cabin in the Trinity Mountains, and about how, for me, positivity and fear rarely go hand in hand. It's far more difficult to celebrate now, more difficult than I ever imagined. When my life is getting scarier, when fire has surrounded me and it's closing in, I'm not going to have a party. I know MS is always going to be with me, and so I'm working to define what my relationship to it truly is. Is multiple sclerosis a battleground for me? Is it a friend? Is it my enemy? Is it both? And if I am fighting it, is it because I hate it? One thing is for certain, I can't control it. I want to honor myself, and that means I have to honor all of me, including the disease that continues to invade every part of my being. I've never wanted to be an MS warrior. Despite my fear of what the future may hold, I've developed a practice of thanking the parts of my body that still allow me to lead a life full of joy. Over the decades, I've borne the scorch of so many new symptoms. Life is persistent and dynamic, and the seedlings pushing up through the char feel like a metaphor for what my life has now become. Cycles of transformation, endings and beginnings, coming bit by tiny bit, or sometimes in a torrent, like so many cyclical bouts and phases of my progressing disease. Each day presents a new challenge, and each day I work to embrace the challenge. I long to be on the porch in the mountains with the sound of the rustling trees and the solitude of the remaining forest as my meditation, where I manage to find a way back home to my sense of self, my ambitions, and inherent joy for life. All I know now is that in this cycle, there is a place for optimism and curiosity. And that is enough for me. A week doesn't go by when I don't receive multiple emails from listeners asking for more information about stem cell therapy for MS. A couple of months ago, at the annual meeting of the America's Committee for Research and Treatment in Multiple Sclerosis, I connected with one of the leading experts in the world on autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, Dr. Jeffrey Cohen. We had a great conversation that touched on Dr. Cohen's definition of innovation in MS research, the emerging research that has him particularly excited, and we talked about hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, and I realized we were touching on things that we really hadn't discussed before. So in a moment, you'll hear my conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Cohen. Dr. Jeffrey Cohen is the Hazel Pryor Hostetler Professor of Neurology at the Cleveland Clinic and the director of the Cleveland Clinic's Mellon Center for Multiple Sclerosis Treatment and Research. Dr. Cohen also heads the Cleveland Clinic's Experimental Therapeutics Program, where he's been involved in a large number of clinical trials, many of which have led to new therapies for multiple sclerosis. And Dr. Cohen is one of the foremost experts in autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, or AHSCT, as a treatment for multiple sclerosis. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Cohen.
Well, it's good to talk to you again, John.
We're here at the ACTRIMS Forum in part to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Boransic Prize, an award that recognizes innovation in MS research. How do you define the term innovation in MS research? What does that mean to you?
Well, for me, innovation means taking a new approach to a disease, either applying new methods or applying new concepts. But it's more than just having a new idea. It's taking that idea to fruition so that it actually has some useful applications.
As someone who helps select Boransic Prize winners, what stands out to you about some of the innovative MS research that you've observed?
So looking back on the previous winners, I would say it covers some of the major advances in the MS field. People that have used a whole new approach to study the disease or who have developed novel ways of treating the disease. You know, I think it's the prize winners represent a who's who in MS research.
As I mentioned a moment ago, one of your areas of expertise is autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, or AHSCT. Can you tell us what that means? What is that process, that procedure?
Well, so hematopoietic stem cell transplantation is a complex, multi-step process that involves several things. So first is a collection of the hematopoietic stem cells, the stem cells that give rise to the blood cells. Then applying what's called a conditioning regimen, which is generally done with high doses of chemotherapy, the purpose of which is to eliminate the existing immune cells. And then readministration of the stem cell graft to help reverse some of the consequences of the conditioning regimen. A couple of points that are worth emphasizing are that, first of all, it's the conditioning regimen that is the MS treatment component. The transplant, in this case, is really to lessen the potential complications of the treatment. Secondly, it's a complicated procedure, and it should really only be done in centers that have not only expertise in transplant, but also expertise in diagnosing and managing MS. And then third, that there still is some uncertainty about the optimal protocol for the whole procedure.
I'm going to circle back to that in just a moment, but I thought we could clarify some of the things that I know are bouncing around the minds of certainly some of my listeners, because they've told me that to begin with. Is autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplant a cure for MS?
No, I think of it as being a very highly effective treatment for MS. It oftentimes can work when medications don't do the job. It also often leads to very long-lasting, durable benefit, where after the procedure, people have long-lasting disease control without the need for restarting disease-modifying therapy. However, it doesn't accomplish that in everybody. Sometimes the benefit's only temporary. And it also doesn't help all aspects of MS. It seems to be much more effective for lesion activity, preventing new relapses and preventing changes on the MRI scan. It seems to be more beneficial for that than in reversing or stopping gradual worsening, what we call progression.
What do you find to be the biggest misconceptions about AHSCT, about among people who are living with MS?
I would say the misconceptions are several things. One is I think many people think that it works for all aspects of MS. And secondly, I think there's an underappreciation of how involved a procedure is and how risky a procedure it is. Unfortunately, I think sometimes people have unrealistic expectations about the procedure. And then I think the other big misconception is that is lack of appreciation that there are many kinds of stem cell approaches, and hematopoietic stem cell transplantation is but one of those. And in particular, it's not intended to specifically reverse the damage that's already occurred. It's the purpose of hematopoietic stem cell transplant is to very effectively stop ongoing damage.
As you alluded to a couple of moments ago, there are two protocols that are used, and they're used, I guess, to ensure that an individual's immune system isn't going to attack the stem cells that are being introduced to their body. One of these protocols is called myeloablative, and the other is non-myeloablative. Can you explain what these two protocols are?
Right. So the intended effect of the conditioning regimen is what's called immunoablation. It's to eliminate the immune system. But sometimes as collateral damage, there may, in addition, be effects on the other aspects of the bone marrow, the other cells that the bone marrow makes, which include red blood cells and other white blood cells. So that's not an intended effect. That's sort of collateral damage. The way that becomes relevant to the conditioning regimen is that there's a range of intensities of conditioning regimens. The strongest, the most intense, in addition to the immunoablation, also cause myeloablation. The idea is that they're more potent, more effective, and that the benefit may be more durable. At the other end of the extreme are the less potent, the less intense regimens, which are more selectively immunoablative but not myeloablative. The main rationale for those is that they're safer, better tolerated, but the concern is that they may not be as effective and the benefit may not last as long. And then there's compromises in between that are somewhat myeloablative but not as intense as the most intense regimens.
Is there a profile yet for the best candidate for autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplant?
Well, we're still learning who's the best candidate, but at this point it looks like it's someone who's relatively young, has had MS for a relatively short period of time, who has very active disease, meaning continued relapses or active MRIs despite treatment. And who does not have other medical conditions that might increase the risk of the transplant. At the other end of the spectrum would be, you know, someone who's older with very long-standing MS, much more severe disability, who's primarily worsening by gradually by progression, and who has not had recent relapses. Unfortunately, they're less likely to benefit and are somewhat more likely to have complications.
The procedure itself is not inexpensive, and that's something that people often point out. But, you know, when you pencil out the math a little bit and perhaps compare that upfront, all-at-once cost, if you will, to AHSCT, and compare it to, say, a few years on a high-efficacy right. disease-modifying therapy, it's sort of a pretty good value at that point. I know that private insurance companies are part of their business is figuring out what a good value is in terms of treatment. I would think that they would be really leading the charge to see this procedure expanded, but we don't see that happening.
Yeah, no, I think you're correct that it's a little bit hard to get a handle on precisely how much hematopoietic stem cell transplantation costs, because it depends to some extent on what complicating factors occur. But you're exactly right that within 2 to 3 years, it may be cost effective, because most of the cost and most of the complications are up front at the time of the procedure. And then if that person has effective disease control that lasts for years and years, within about 2 or 3 years, it's cost effective as compared to the ongoing cost of disease modifying therapies, which themselves are expensive. So one of the purposes of one of the ongoing studies that I happen to be directing, BEAT-MS, among other things, is to look at the health economic aspects of it, and hopefully to show that transplant works. It's a good alternative to disease-modifying therapies for the appropriate person, and that it's cost-effective. And then that will help convince payers to cover it.
I'm looking forward to that day. Dr. Jeffrey Cohen, thank you for all you do every day to improve the lives of people living with MS, and thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks, John.
We tend to talk about clinical trials often on this podcast because I believe that research is the engine that creates the future. And right now, I want to invite you to be a part of it. I want to share an invitation for some of you to participate in the Targeted Exercise for African Americans with Multiple Sclerosis, or the TEAMS, that's T-E-A-A-M-S, study. Recent research has shown that African Americans have an increased risk of developing MS, and that the course of the disease tends to be more severe among African Americans who are living with MS. And although exercise has been shown to benefit people with MS at every stage of the disease, there are few primary care and MS clinics that provide full exercise and rehabilitation services for people with MS, especially in low-income areas in the southeastern United States. So a research team from the University of Illinois Chicago College of Applied Health Sciences, in conjunction with the University of Alabama Birmingham, is launching a 16-week study focusing on two home-based exercise programs. One program will consist of both aerobic and resistance training exercises, while the other program will focus on stretching and flexibility as an important part of fitness. Both programs have been designed specifically for adults living with MS and will be adjusted based upon each participant's needs, capabilities, and experiences. Materials for completing the programs, things like yoga mats, resistance bands, and training manuals, will be provided to everyone, and they're yours to keep after the study ends. And study participants will receive a $90 gift card in compensation for completing the team's study. The study is recruiting African Americans over the age of 18 who are living with MS in Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Tennessee. For more information or to register to participate in the Targeted Exercise for African Americans with Multiple Sclerosis study, you can visit the study's website at projectteams.ahs.uic.edu, and I'm going to spell that out for you. That's projectteams. ahs.uic.edu, or you can call area code 833-727-1887, and you'll find that link and that phone number in today's show notes. Symptoms like numbness, tingling, and pain are just some of the common MS sensory symptoms that can have a negative impact on your quality of life. Joining me in a moment with strategies designed to help you manage those sensory symptoms is my guest, Dr. Jeffrey Hernandez. Numbness, tingling, that electric shock you sometimes feel at the back of your neck, these are just some of the common sensory symptoms that people living with MS might experience. Joining me to help us better understand what these altered sensations are and how they can be treated is Dr. Jeffrey Hernandez. Dr. Hernandez is a doctorally prepared nurse practitioner who specializes in multiple sclerosis. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Hernandez.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
What are we referring to when we talk about sensory symptoms, and which sensory symptoms are most common in MS?
So sensory symptoms in the simplest form is a result of damage done to the nerves that are caused and consequence by the MS lesions. And these lesions can be located either in the brain or the spinal cord, cervical or thoracic spine. These sensations or these symptoms are altered sensations, and they can be numbness. They can be described as pain, maybe even in some cases increased sensitivity, such as like a tingling, a crawling, a prickling sensation. Many times when it's painful, patients will tell you that it's like a burning sensation, a stabbing sensation. And then some people report itching.
Are these MS-related sensory symptoms permanent?
They can be permanent. They really can be permanent. Many times they will be transient, meaning that they'll be short-lived. They'll happen for a while and then improve. So they're usually often temporary, but they can be permanent. They could be progressive, so they actually can worsen from your onset, and they may occur to different parts of the body. These sensory symptoms usually do go away even without treatment if one related to a relapse. So if you're having a relapse and you're experiencing these altered sensations to your body, your provider may decide to treat with the steroids to kind of hasten and improve the recovery period. But depending on your conversation and what your pros and cons are, they might opt to say no, steroids are required at that point, and these symptoms can very well improve.
A moment ago, I referred to that sensation that feels like an electric shock going down the back of your neck. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. That is something that people like when you put a name to. It's called Lhermitte sign, or what we often refer to as Lhermitte phenomenon. It's usually a transient stabbing electric shock-like sensation that radiates down the back, the spine, as well into the arms and legs. And it's usually triggered by neck flexion. So bringing your chin to your chest or moving your head side to side may trigger this sensation to occur. And often, again, due to a damage done from an MS lesion in the upper cervical spine, if this were to occur for the very first time, it could be a sign of a relapse or a new lesion. So this is something very important that you discuss with your provider if it's the first time that you're experiencing it.
If someone is experiencing tingling or numbness in their fingertips, for instance, does that mean that the tissue on their fingertips is being damaged?
When it's related to MS, it should not. There should not be any damage done to the tissue. Everything should be clear and intact. So your fingertips, for example, should look like your normal fingertips. The damage occurs on the nerves, which then disrupts the electrical conduction and those nerves that are no longer myelinated, they're demyelinated. And so that's what makes it seem like there's something wrong with your fingertips. But there should not be any damage or rashes or any changes to your skin whatsoever.
Numbness can be tricky for someone to deal with. If you're experiencing numbness in your legs or your feet, it can get in the way of a lot of your everyday activities. Are there any strategies or precautions people should keep in mind when it comes to managing numbness?
Yeah, I mean, you know, hopefully, and for many, it might be a small area and may not be so bothersome. But then in some of the severe cases, you could have numbness that affects a larger portion of their body and really does impair their ability to do their activities of daily living or, you know, function normally. So in the case of someone complaining of numbness to their feet or their legs, the first thing that I typically recommend on a practicality is like, you know, making sure they wear well-fitted shoes, they wear them. That they look inside the shoes. You know, I think one patient once told me that he didn't realize he was stepping on something inside the shoe. And moving forward, I've always mentioned that to everyone when they tell me that they have numbness to their feet, or I examine them and they don't realize that they have changes to the sensations in their feet. Like, remove any sharp objects that might have fallen into the shoe. Examine your feet daily. I mean, I know it seems very simple because we have a day-to-day routine. So when you're putting on your socks to put on your shoes, or maybe in the shower when you're cleaning your body and you're cleaning your feet, look at your skin, make sure that there are no changes, that there are no skin breakdowns or signs of infection. Those are important tips. When all those things are done in the clinic, we often may refer to physical therapy for like balance and gait training. And that's really more of an effort to maintain independence and make sure that you're doing things safely. And then there are some patients that may benefit from a home assessment or a home evaluation by occupational therapy. And that's really just to work one-on-one with the person and see if there's anything that they can do around their home to improve their environment so that they can do their daily activities as they once could, maybe reaching the top shelf, maybe they're walking and they're tripping over a rug because they can't feel the difference. So those are just some of the things that they can do with the person.
I have a three-part question for you. First, what is proprioception? What are the risks of impaired proprioception? And how does someone with MS know if they have impaired proprioception?
Sure. So, I mean, if you were to close your eyes and move your arms and legs, you would know where your body and limb are in space. So that's essentially what proprioception is. You need normal proprioception, or normal proprioception is important to maintain balance and coordination. So a form of numbness is the loss of position sense, or what we often refer to in the clinic when we're examining joint position sense, where we can test your toes and your fingertips to see if there's an impaired proprioception. But many times what people will describe to us if there is an impairment there is they might notice issues with balance. Maybe they feel uncoordinated. They may have uncoordinated movement of their legs or their arms, or they tell me that they'll feel clumsy. I have one person who's a teacher. She's like, I feel clumsy all the time when I'm working with the students. So that might be something that they notice. They might be looking where they place their feet because they don't want to fall or trip. So those are just some of the things that may occur because of this issue.
Pain is another common sensory symptom that's associated with MS. What are the different types of pain that people living with MS might experience?
People with MS may experience, unfortunately, many types of pain, including in the face and in the eye. So if they have facial pain, that might be a trigeminal neuralgia, often one-sided. So it might be either affecting the left side, the right side of the face, or a portion of that side. They may experience pain with eye movement, and that's typically during an optic neuritis when they have inflammation on the optic nerve. They may have pain when they're looking to the left, to the right. That's often what prompts them to seek care. Lhermitte's phenomenon or sign or symptom may be painful in some cases. Although it's transient, it may happen sporadically and it may just be quick. It could be quite painful. And then we have other people that might say that they have increased sensitivity to different parts of their body, or like a burning sensation, for an example, in the leg or the hand. And in some cases, muscle spasms, although often not necessarily painful, they can become quite painful in some patients. So those are some of the pains that people with MS can experience.
What types of treatments are available for these sensory symptoms? And for the people who may feel like they're already taking enough medications, are there ways people can manage these symptoms without medication?
There are treatments for most of the symptoms. Obviously, it might be difficult to treat depending on the severity of the symptom, but we always try. So some of the medicines that we use could be in the form of antidepressants. It could be antiepileptics or seizure medications that we use for seizure. Some medications that you use for seizure that you also use for headaches may work for pain. Some of them are FDA approved for like a peripheral neuropathy that may work for MS type pain. Or again, I mentioned an antidepressant that may help with pain. So those medications help to calm or settle down the nerve overactivity. Some of the non-pharmacological treatment options could be like a self-help group, a biofeedback, if you can find someone or a person that's trained to do that, hypnosis. I mean, I haven't had many people tell me that they've done that, but I have read on that. Yoga is probably one of the more common ones, maybe yoga, meditation, working with the therapist, acupuncture, massage therapy for the spasms, actually. Massage therapy is something that I do sometimes recommend for my patients when they're experiencing painful muscle spasms in combination with their medicine.
I don't want to forget this one. I know a lot of people living with MS experience that familiar sensation of tightness around their chest called the MS hug. So what is the MS hug? What causes it? And what can someone do about it?
Yeah, tightness is one way that you can describe it. It could be uncomfortable, could be painful. Some people might describe it as pressure or squeezing. I've had some patients say that it feels like a band-like sensation. It's often one-sided, so it may occur either on the left or the right side of the chest or stomach or abdomen. And this may occur due to changes of the sensation in that area, or even from muscle spasms to the small muscles between the ribs, again, as a consequence of these lesions that may occur in the spinal cord.
You recently co-authored a study that focused on the characteristics of itch in multiple sclerosis. Can you tell us what you and your team learned and how the results of your research might impact people with MS who experience chronic itch?
Sure. So our team actually collaborated with our dermatology group. They have an itch center, so they have an itch specialist. And so I think we did this in 2021, where we recruited 77 patients. 35% of the patients actually reported pruritus. It had a specific pattern and distribution to it, often affected the extremities. So meaning the upper extremities is what was most commonly reported amongst those patients, and many times associated with the lesion, either in the brainstem, so the lower part of the brain, or the cervical spine. Most noted that the itching actually happened intermittently, meaning that it wasn't constant. So sometimes when you think of an MS symptom, you'll say, okay, it's probably constant, but these patients actually reported that it happened intermittently, meaning that it would come and go, mainly in the evenings, which again kind of coincides with some of the other symptoms that they experience, like fatigue in the afternoons. And many patients actually report that it happened more often during the spring or the summertime, so earlier in the year when it's usually more hot and humid, at least in Florida, compared to the fall. So, you know, it kind of, again, goes hand in hand with some of the symptoms that they typically experience worse throughout with heat. So like fatigue, for example, those with itch actually did report more frequently comorbidities compared to those that did not experience itch. And those comorbidities could have been fatigue, heat sensitivity, anxiety, and depression. We have some literature that shows that about 4% of the prevalence of itch is about 4% in the patients with MS. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough information to make that conclusion in our study, and so we couldn't really identify a true prevalence, but we do think that it is higher than 4%. And so that opens up eyes when someone is complaining of itch, you know, to make sure that they reach out to their providers and discuss their symptoms and not just chuck it, because we know that it does come and go. So you may experience it and may go away and then you forget about it. So write it down on your phone or write it down on your calendar, write it down somewhere if you can't remember, if you don't think you'll remember, and talk to your provider the next time you see them and mention it to them.
Well, Dr. Jeffrey Hernandez, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And I hope everyone is doing well.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/295. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll do me a huge favor and choose to participate in the Real Talk MS Listener Survey. The survey will take you less than 5 minutes to complete, and it could mean a $100 Amazon gift card for you. You'll find the survey at realtalkms.com/survey, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.